and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with David J. Stump, Professor of Philosophy at the University of San Francisco. His new book, Conceptual Change and the Philosophy of Science, Alternative Interpretations of the A Priori, is just out from Routledge. Ever since Kant argued that there was a category of truths, the synthetic a priori, that grounded the possibility of empirical knowledge, philosophers have debated the concept of a priori knowledge in science. Science is based on empirical knowledge based in sense experience, but are there also kinds of scientific knowledge that are not empirical? In particular, are mathematical claims in science of this sort? Stump argues that there is an important sense of a priori knowledge in science, but that it is pragmatic and dynamic. On his view, the a priori in science is better understood as the constitutive elements of science, the truths that must be presupposed for empirical inquiry to take place, but without implying that these truths are universal and fixed, as Kant and others have held. Stump contrasts his view with those of Poincaré, Carnap, Quine, Friedman, and other writers, and argues that the functional a priori can account for the role of mathematics in science, as well as the rationality of science through revolutionary conceptual change. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, David Stump. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy to be talking about your new book, Conceptual Change and the Philosophy of Science. You give a very, very nice tour of, you know, all the various positions on the nature of the a priori in science, starting obviously with the case of Kant, who kind of raised the problem to begin with, and then going through what you consider two different traditions of responses, the logical positivist one, and then a tradition that you call the sort of pragmatist or functional tradition. So before we get into the details of the book, I like to find out a little bit about you as a philosopher, and then how you came to write about this particular topic.
Okay, as an undergraduate at Berkeley, was very fascinated by worldviews and the idea that we have changing conceptions of reality through history and cross-culturally as well. And of course, these raise the issue of relativism very immediately. This was kind of the backdrop generally of my interest in conceptual change in science and related topics. And I had very pluralistic training in philosophy. I went to Northwestern for graduate school, and it was just at a time when it was developing a philosophy of science program and still had a strong continental program. So I got a wide range of perspectives and methodologies, studied history of philosophy quite seriously and things like that. So when I came to choose a dissertation topic, rather than deal with things on a kind of broad epistemological way, dealing with relativism or something, I decided to go into philosophy of science and look at Henri Poincaré's conventionalism about space-time. And that was a very concrete and specific example of a way that there might be a worldview or a convention, something that we choose that has an effect on the way reality is considered. And I studied his philosophy of space-time conventionalism in my dissertation, and I've been working on Poincaré ever since, and of course he plays a big role in the book. But for this book, I wanted to expand the topic back to a wider issue and basically take on the general idea of conceptual change in science through the various alternative theories of the a priori, that is the relative a priori or historical a priori, historical epistemology, pragmatist theory of the a priori, all of the functionalist theory, all these names are a family of theories that say that things that Kant took to be fixed and universal turned out to change over time, and that is what explains then conceptual change in science.
So, I mean, one of the ways that you, well, you begin the book with a kind of a brief tour of non-Euclidean geometry, right? With the rejection of the parallel postulate, among other things. Can you say a bit about, you know, why that, you know, the changes in geometries or the possibility of non-Euclidean geometries was such a, you know, sort of foundation-shaking aspect of science, you know, as it entered, say, the post-Newtonian era? You know, because Kant, of course, had begun explaining, you know, positing the synthetic a priori in response to certain skeptical doubts that, you know, from Hume. And there was no reason to really question that sort of a priori before the very foundations that he thought were fixed turned out, like, not to be fixed. So can you give us a little bit of the background that you kind of pack into that one chapter, but to kind of lay the groundwork for Poincaré and the other figures who follow?
Okay. Well, non-Euclidean geometries were a major revolution, not so much for mathematicians, perhaps, but for philosophers. And that's basically because Kant put such an emphasis on space and geometry and time and arithmetic, respectively, in his theory of how we experience reality and how we have knowledge. Basically, geometry is the foundation of what he calls our external sensuous intuition, that is our intuition of our experience of things around us are all in space necessarily, and he thought must be in Euclidean space, the traditional geometry basically that everyone learns in high school, and, you know, where there's one parallel going through a point off a given line. Every line has one parallel through a given point. And the whole reason he invented the theory of synthetic a priori is to explain what he took to be the necessity of Euclidean geometry. And you have a parallel story in arithmetic as founding our intuition about time, things happening in sequence one after the other. So when mathematicians discovered alternatives to Euclidean geometry, no one really noticed, actually, until Helmholtz very pointedly, and Riemann also, but Helmholtz especially, wrote two articles where he said, listen, Kant says you can't represent anything but Euclidean geometry, and represent in German is Vorstellung. And and he said, nonsense, we can represent other geometries, and gives a little argument to make that case. And this was in two articles, as I say, in 1868 and 1870, I believe. And that's when philosophers suddenly sat up and took notice that, wait a minute, this is a big challenge to Kant's theory, because space and time and geometry and arithmetic are foundations to how we experience the world and know things in the world. And if there are alternatives, this seems to say that Kant was wrong. And, you know, just the issue of the conception of space, of course, is a big issue in itself. Different theories, Newton's absolute theory of space and Leibniz's relational theory of space, and Poincaré comes down on Leibniz's side on that one. But so there's already it's already a big topic within philosophy of science, and it was made a big topic in general in philosophy because of the effect it had on Kant. Now, of course, there are defenses of Kant. Basically, the most interesting one is that not only is Kant consistent with the existence of non-Euclidean geometries, but he predicts them, because he says that arithmetic and geometry are synthetic. That is to say, they're not just true by virtue of logical manipulation of symbols, but rather substantially they say something about the world. And if non-Euclidean geometries were inconsistent, then and there was only the only logical possible geometry was Euclidean, then in that case geometry would be analytic, and that isn't what Kant says. So the possibility of other geometries as logical possibilities actually is consistent with Kant. So that's what some neo-Kantians said. But other neo-Kantians just bit the bullet and said, all right, we'll give up the idea of the sensuous intuitions of space and time, and we'll keep the categories of the understanding. Other a priori synthetic things like that every event has a cause, and that substance exists through time, and things like that. So they just bit the bullet and said, we'll give up on that, we'll accept it. But you see, this is a huge impact. Kant was very influential, and basically non-Euclidean geometries, the existence of non-Euclidean geometries, had a huge impact on the field because of the position of Kant and how it seemed to refute him. They had to respond in some way. Of course, the people I'm looking at respond by saying these things that were considered to be a priori by Kant turn out to be things that can change through time and in different scientific systems, different scientific theories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the questions that I had been thinking was, you know, why it took, I think, philosophers, you know, decades to kind of accept what the mathematicians had accepted, you know, in the 1870s. It took a while for philosophers to come around, and I suppose part of that was just Kant had a certain stature in philosophy that no doubt he did not have in mathematics.
That's right. And also, you know, there's a funny thing about revolutions in mathematics. It's the only field where they keep all the old theories. In physical science, in astronomy, for example, you have Ptolemaic theory of the planets, where the Earth is in the center of the universe. And when you get Copernicus and the putting the sun in the center of the solar system with the Earth revolving around the sun instead of the sun revolving around the Earth, you suddenly have to throw away 10,000 years worth of work in effect, and start all over again with your charts and things like that. And in chemistry, famously, you know, you have this phlogiston theory before the discovery of oxygen, and Lavoisier showing how to make a theory based on oxygen and saying that phlogiston doesn't exist at all. And, you know, and then the work, the empirical work that went into theories of phlogiston kind of gets thrown away also. Sometimes this is called Kuhn loss after Thomas Kuhn, revolutionary changes. But in math, and it's the only field like this, I think, you never throw anything away. Everything is always maintained. So just because you discover new geometries, mathematicians just say, oh, well, there are more geometries. Euclidean geometry is the geometry of flat surfaces, and non-Euclidean geometries either are of negatively curved curvatures in the surfaces, in the case of Bolyai-Lobachevsky or hyperbolic geometry, or positively curved surfaces in the case of Riemannian or spherical geometry, or elliptical sometimes also it's called, depending on little details. But anyway, the point is that mathematicians could just see this as, oh, another geometry, great, you know, more tools to work with. Whereas for philosophers, it really seemed like they were losing something, namely Kant's theory of space and time.
Yeah. So Poincaré, I think, is, you mentioned him before. I mean, he's a major figure here. And he has sort of pride of place in your account of historical figures who have dealt with the a priori. I mean, there's a number. We won't get through all of them. But in particular, he had a very, very influential view of conventionalism. Right. But as you point out, well, you know, I mean, a lot of people have accused him of being inconsistent, or, you know, right, somehow saying one thing on one day and a different thing on another day. And your view, he had actually a very mixed account of the a priori, and that his view of conventionalism itself had different parts to it. One that had to deal with metric geometry, and another type of conventionalism for principles. So could you say a word about Poincaré and how he kind of set things up in this kind of post-Kantian era?
Well, first of all, he maintains something like a Kantian a priori, although it's not exactly the same because it's not connected to time in his view. We don't have an intuition of time, but he does have the idea that the fundamental principles of arithmetic are synthetic a priori in an old-fashioned sense. And he thinks the situation is quite different for geometry. He thinks geometry is conventional. That is, specifically the metric of geometry is conventional, whether you take space to be flat or curved is a matter of convention, just like he says, in a very misleading metaphor, perhaps, different temperature scales. You have Fahrenheit and centigrade, and, you know, you can use one or the other, and it doesn't matter. And he says the situation is something like that with geometries. You can use Euclidean geometry. That's simpler, so he thinks that's the one that people will use. Or you could use non-Euclidean geometry and still do physics. So that's the conventionality of space now, and of geometry. Now, he has another way he talks about conventions, which is the conventions of principles. And that's actually closer to what I'm dealing with in the book with the alternative theories of the a priori, because what those are is something like fundamental presuppositions or fundamental conceptions that are necessary to get science going, but aren't, at least if they are empirical at all, and they are synthetic, that is, they do tell you about the real world, but if they are empirical, it's only in a kind of a strange way, or a kind of way that takes a lot of work. It's not like going out in the forest and finding a new species of frog where you just, oh, I found something and I'm observing it now, et cetera, et cetera. These fundamental presuppositions are so basic and so fundamental that we can't simply discover them like that. We have to have them in place before we can do our science. And that's things like Newton's laws of motion, for example, which I talk about in the book also, have been considered these kind of fundamental principles. You need these fundamental principles before you can do Newtonian physics, before you can do anything really in the sciences. And that is what Poincaré is talking about, the kind of thing he's talking about with conventionality of principles. That is, there are alternative principles that we could use in some cases. He thinks these are pretty limited, actually, which is interesting. And that is, there's a small number of them, because some things turn out to be just empirical. And he thinks that, of course, the conventionality of space is just one thing, conventionality of geometry or space. So that's pretty limited, too. So Poincaré has a fairly conservative viewpoint on this. And as I say, he also maintains the synthetic a priori for arithmetic. So again, you know, he has a rather limited and conservative view.
Okay, so yes. I guess in the other direction. I mean, you in the beginning, and then later on, of course, you know, the figure of Quine comes up.
Right.
You know, periodically, and he, of course, famously says, well, there is no a priori. It's just a matter of what's more entrenched or not. There's a core stuff is entrenched, peripheral stuff is not, and that's the end of the story. And a lot of, you know, other sort of non-Kantian or neo-Kantian figures in between, from the logical positivists, through to Friedman, and you also discuss hacking. The differences among these positions is really one of determining how do we account for this special status? Quine does it in terms of, you know, just entrenchment. You disagree with that. Maybe from a historical perspective, after Poincaré, the major approach was generally the logical positivist tradition, right? Maybe you can say something about how they conceived of the status of these a priori truths.
Yeah, the things that had been considered a priori by Kant were considered by the logical positivists to fall into two possibilities. Either they were merely analytic, that is, they are just matters of definition and what follows logically, or they are synthetic and they're and empirical. That is, things to be known through this sensation or through experiment or something like that. So, in other words, if you look at the possibilities. Kant said some things are analytic, some things are synthetic, some things are a priori, some things are empirical. And he had a special category for things that are both synthetic and a priori. And the logical positivist just said, well, that category is empty. That's the empiricist position, which goes back to Hume, of course. Hume said there's either relations of ideas, which is like the analytic ideas, or there are these substantial empirical truths or falsehoods, so they narrowed it down. They got rid of the synthetic a priori, and that, like I say, is the empiricist, the pure empiricist kind of view. Quine also has a purely empirical view by saying that everything is ultimately empirical in some sense or other. He waffles a little bit on logic and mathematics in the end of his life, but that's for now. I mean, I'm following Michael Friedman. I'm using Quine as the alternative to someone who does not believe in a synthetic a priori or an a priori at all, really.
So I guess, Quine would put him, I mean, your major figures for the alternative to the logical positivist view, which you characterize variously as the pragmatic tradition with the American pragmatists, some of them, or the functional a priori. I wasn't sure if those were the same thing. But in the alternative, what you call an alternative tradition, your major figures are Ernst Cassirer, mm-hmm. If I've said that correctly, C.I. Yeah. Lewis, and Arthur Papp. And you note that Quine was not kind of a prominent person in that group, as far as I could see. Yeah. And you see your own view as being a sort of within the Pappian view, I suppose, or maybe a development of Arthur Papp's view. So can you explain what characterizes that group of people that you consider as defending various versions of the pragmatic a priori?
Well, starting with Cassirer, who I say the least about, but he, there's a lot to say about him, really. But apparently he has a view that, you know, that things that Kant thought were a priori, some fundamental principles, can change in different periods as science develops. But at the same time, he thought we should look for even deeper and more basic principles that remain constant through all time. So he has a halfway step, as it were. That is, you start out noticing that there are things that Kant had taken to be fixed and universal that in fact have changed, like the non-Euclidean geometry case. But the task then, according to Cassirer, is to look for even deeper principles that are in fact universal and are in fact fixed, or would ideally be fixed. Now, that's that's how it should be described, I suppose, as a neo-Kantian view. He's usually labeled a neo-Kantian. The pragmatists go further and say, well, there are these things that have changed that Kant thought were universal and fixed, And we shouldn't be looking for a deeper story. Everything is up for grabs as a possible, everything is fallible. So everything is up for grabs as a possible thing that could change with further developments in science. And, you know, this is famously posited by C.I. Lewis. He has an article called The Pragmatic Theory of the A Priori, and then he develops that in his book, Mind and World Order. But in a sense, he's got a very narrow view in that it turns out he really only has one example, which is Einstein's argument for the conventionality of simultaneity. And that turns out to be a rather controversial example on top of it, on top of there only being one. So I'm a little concerned about his view. Arthur Papp goes much further and says really anything in the right context could be considered a constitutive element, that is an a priori element of a science, and things change their roles. Sometimes they're constitutive and sometimes they're empirical in different contexts, in different theories. And so that's the direction that I see as being correct. The only place I would say I disagree with Papp is that he tends to put things in linguistic form. He was very much an analytic philosopher and likes to think of things in terms of definitions, in terms of meaning of terms and things like that. I'm much more in the camp of thinking of science in terms of a practice, and the practice, and including of more than just language, that is physical practices and machinery and all kinds of things should be included in our analysis of science, I think. So that's where I go further than Papp. Of course, people like Friedman and Thomas Kuhn and Ian Hacking have similar views as well, although they couch them mostly in different terms, although Friedman's pretty close to that. So that's the kind of tradition that I'm trying to highlight. I think Cassira and Lewis, I mean, we're talking about people writing in the teens and 20s, and then Papp in the 40s and 50s, do constitute a different track for philosophy of science than what was presented by the logical positivists, or if you want to call them logical empiricists. I'm taking the two names as being synonymous. Some people didn't like logical positivist, and some people prefer logical empiricist, but I'm taking them to mean the same thing. So I see this as an alternative to the logical positivists, because they take the a priori more seriously and don't try to do that pure empirical reduction of the synthetic a priori.
So Quine, I mean, you criticize his view as saying his distinction between core and periphery is really not sufficient, as far as I understand it, to draw the status distinction.
Well,
that you want, or at least that was the impression I got. Could you explain your?
The best way to bring this is probably with an example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the prime examples of what Michael Friedman and others, including me, have thought of as a constitutive principle or a relative a priori, if you will, is something like the calculus in Newtonian physics. You have to have the calculus as a tool in order to do Newtonian physics. If you're going to calculate the planets as they orbit around the sun, or you're going to do pretty much anything, you need calculus. And that's what we mean by a necessary precondition in Kantian language, or a constitutive element of the Newtonian theory. Calculus is something you have to have in place as a tool before you can do anything. Now, Quine would say in his theory that, well, oh, sure, I can explain this. He's got a purely empirical theory. Calculus is entrenched. That is, it's in the center of the web of belief, and something we're going to be less likely to change than something out on the periphery. And what does he mean by entrenchment? Well, there's two things he says about entrenchment. One is that it's uncontroversial. Everyone accepts it. And two, that it's been around a long time. Calculus, to take that as our prime example, does not fit either of those requirements of entrenchment. When Newton was using it in the Principia, he had just invented it. He, along with Leibniz, of course, but it was brand new. And it was not uncontroversial. It wasn't uncontroversial until much later, when people like Cauchy and Weier Strauss and people like that put it on a sound logical footing, and you get what's called the rigorization of the calculus, you know, a century later, or centuries later. So it's not entrenched. The calculus is not entrenched according to Quine's own criteria. And that's just as an example of why I think something like entrenchment doesn't capture the right notion for trying to understand what's going on in the sciences. And I should give a footnote here to Michael Friedman, because he's developed this argument.
Okay. Well, I mean, couldn't Quine say, I mean, this just occurred to me.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't entrenched when it was introduced. You know, for all we knew, the calculus maybe might not have worked. You know, maybe it looked like a good device, and it turned out a few years later, wait a minute, this is not, you know, the best way to go. And then it became entrenched. I mean, that seems to be consistent with his view, to say that things needn't, you know, it would seem that if you want to have a core periphery distinction be sufficient, that you could easily say, well, when something first is introduced, obviously it's not going to be core, but things can become core.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, the what I would say is that it depends on if you want to accept, I mean, the view you're expressing is a retrospective view. From our current standpoint, calculus is not controversial, and it's been around a long time. Mm-hmm. But if you're requiring, as an understanding of the development of science, what was going on at the time rather than retrospectively, then Quine won't do that. So it depends on what your historiography requirements are, in effect.
Yeah.
Need something that can work in real time to understand what science is doing, or is it all right to have kind of a retroactive reconstruction? And I would hold out for something that works in real time, that is, that works historically within the framework that was given at the time. Now, this is, gets to be a very complex story. In fact, one of the things I have a footnote for in the book is that, you know, there's a controversy over whether Newton himself actually used the calculus in his own physics. So is it really necessary? Actually, the best work by someone I can't remember right now, Italian guy, seems to say that he did, in fact, use calculus in Principia. Uh-huh. But there is controversy about that. And it shows, you know, that, I mean, when you really get into the history, it's quite a rich thing and not something you can... philosophers tend to like reconstructions and
explanations
of messy history.
Well, let me just I guess the question is how do you get a real-time conception, as you put it, of the a priori that really gets you the status that that we associate with the a priori. I mean, I understand you want to get rid of the language, you know, a priori. Let's just call them constitutive elements of science. And that's fine. You know, so that's all I mean by a priori is constitutive right. elements. But even to have a constitutive element, that seems to be much, much stronger than, well, I'm taking this as a presupposition now, and that seems fine. But you know, whenever you set up an experiment or anything, there's all kinds of things that are presupposed, and it would seem that for something to count not merely as presupposed but as a priori or constitutive, there has to be something more than that. And the real-time issue is, well, in real time, you may not, it's probably really difficult to know, you know, which of things, those things are going to be constitutive, which, you know, as opposed to merely, you know, presupposed and taken for granted.
Well, you look at, what you have to do is look at scientific practice, and a lot of things you will find, you know, I mean, you can dig out what the presuppositions are. And the thing I would say about what makes something constitutive, I mean, it is largely just, you know, a necessary precondition for, so whatever that, you know, phrase captures. So in that sense, it is just a condition, a hypothetical, but there are little hints that there's something stronger going on. One is that like I say, with the example of the calculus, you can't do the physics at all without that presupposition. It's not quite like you're just, oh, I'll assume this, you know, and I mean, it's like really essential science. Another thing I would say, and this comes up in my the first example I give in the book, which is of
the petri dish,
a petri dish with a growth in it, and saying, "Oh, this petri dish is contaminated," and that example is not as strong as the calculus example. I think it is more like just a precondition or entrenchment or something, that why spontaneous generation is not considered as a live possibility. But where I say that it becomes something a little stronger is that the scientist is actually using the non-existence of spontaneous generation as a criterion. That is, having a growth in the sealed petri dish is something that is a criterion of contamination. That is, it means contamination. And that's something a little bit stronger merely than presupposing. That is, the use of that presupposition is has got a real epistemological bite to it. It's criterion for when something is sterile or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean. That's what I would say is the something more than just a presupposition. Although, you know, like I say, I mean, I think I do mean by constitutive presuppositions. Are all presuppositions constitutive? Well, if they're central enough to the science, I kind of want to say yes, actually. But you know, like a pragmatist, I don't think there are fixed categories that are black and white on any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's always a continuum. So, you know, there are going to be stronger examples of constitutive elements and weaker examples of constitutive elements. Things that are presuppositions in a way that is really necessary for the science, and presuppositions which are weaker requirements for the science.
Right, or necessary for that experiment that day, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's not really the science.
And that's fine, because as Pap points out, you know, things are constitutive in a context. That is, you know, they may be perfectly empirical in some context and perfectly not empirical, perfectly constitutive in another context.
So, I mean, this kind of gets us to Michael Friedman's view, neo-Kantian view, and your criticism of him, because he gives a sort of a special role to philosophy.
Right.
In terms of providing a kind of continuous rational foundation for science, even through, you know, Kuhnian revolutions.
Right.
You argue that there is no such special role for philosophy, and that's actually a kind of a Quinean point too, right?
Right. Yeah.
Can you say something about that criticism there?
In one sense of the very multifaceted term, I'm a naturalist. That is, in terms of science and philosophy being continuous, I don't want to make a sharp distinction between the two fields the way Michael Friedman seems to be committed to. But basically, what surprises me a little with Friedman on this view is he seems to take Kuhn's problematic very seriously and think that he needs to answer the question of what maintains continuity, since Kuhn has an argument that there is no continuity across revolutions, that is, across changes in paradigm, which is what a revolution is by definition. Because of incommensurability between two paradigms, there's no continuity, even in things that look continuous, like going from Newton to Einstein. Quine has an argument. Kuhn, excuse me, has an argument that they're not continuous because they're talking about the same word in different ways, so there's a meaning change going on.
Mm-hmm.
With things like mass and things like that. But anyway, Friedman takes this very seriously, but I'm a little surprised by that, just simply because there's been a lot of discussion of Kuhn's work, and I would have thought by the time Friedman was writing the book, there were a lot of answers to Kuhn. I think my answer, and I'm following people like Larry Loudon and Dudley Shapir and others who tried to argue in a non-foundationalist way against Kuhn, I think there's enough continuity within science itself without adding a layer of philosophy to make the continuity. Just another way of saying I don't accept Kuhn's incommensurability thesis.
Right.
But part of what's going on there is, you know, I studied Poincaré, and one of the first things I learned in studying Poincaré was that there are these figures who are exactly in between the big paradigms. I mean, and then he's not completely Newtonian, and he's not completely Einsteinian or relativity theory either, and neither is Lorentz and others in there. And so there's a lot more continuity, I think, in science itself than Kuhn is. Kuhn's picture allows for. And because of that, I think Friedman's response is just not necessary. He's answering a question that doesn't need to be answered, in effect.
Okay. So how about, like, metaphysical principles? I mean, a lot of philosophers will maintain that, you know, there's a sort of metaphysical foundations. I mean, that's a very popular topic these days, is, you know, the metaphysical foundations of physics. Where are those, on your view, constitutive principles, you know, like mathematical principles, and they're just in the mix somehow?
I think they would be probably constitutive in this, if there are necessary preconditions, I mean, necessary presuppositions to do the science. What I would say is, if you've got something that looks like it's universal and you know, you can't imagine any alternative, that just means that that you've got a principle that may change but hasn't yet, because everything I take to be fallible. I mean, that's my bottom line principle, as it were. And there again, I'm agreeing with Quine. You know, all principles are fallible, agreeing with Peirce in the original setting up of fallibilism. And I'm not impressed by arguments that would say that, you know, there's something absolute or universal about certain metaphysical principles. I don't know any alternatives, but, you know, there's, I mean, even logic has alternative logic. So I think there's, if you look closely, there are more alternatives than people know about. And secondly, you know, there's a long history of people claiming that they have a universal and absolute principle from Kant on, Kant and before and after, to only to turn out to be wrong. Science got them wrong. They're wrong. We thought every event has a cause. Well, radioactive decay seems to happen in a totally random way without any cause. We thought that nature doesn't make jumps, and quantum mechanics shows us that an electron gets from one shell to another with never being in between. You know, and these are puzzling things to our intuitions, but that's what science keeps telling us over and over again.
Okay, so I mean, this kind of brings us to the at the very end. You focus on the issue of mathematics in science, which is, you know, in a sense, that's kind of ground zero for this whole debate. Is, you know, what do we do about mathematics in science? Because, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, and it seems irrelevant that, you know, not only can't we think of an alternative, but it just seems like there isn't one. You know, obviously with geometry, the parallel path, you know, we might have had those intuitions before, but we learned they're wrong. But fallibilism across the board, you know, a lot of people in philosophy of mathematics, which, as you know, note in, you know, it got its impetus. It started from the whole problem of the, you know, the status of geometry and so forth. So in that final chapter, you address the mathematics, the role of mathematics, the status of mathematics in science. specifically, and you discussed the role of the indispensability arguments, right? Math is indispensable in science, and this is taken to be an argument for Platonism of some sort. And that, of course, would imply that we have some sort of mathematical intuition to which we have access to these Platonic objects. And that whole picture to you is kind of anathema, I take it. Okay.
The main thing is that and the main point of that chapter is that I've been talking about the role of mathematics in science throughout the book, and
right.
I knew that was a crucial example, and you know, people would probably be wondering, well, what about all the issues in philosophy and mathematics
right.
that come up? And what I try to argue in the last chapter is that my theory of constitutive elements in science is neutral. That is, it's compatible with various positions in philosophy of mathematics. I don't want to be committed to one theory or another of mathematics in my theory. I think that's the strongest position to be in. For example, Quine is committed to an empiricist view of mathematics because he takes everything to be to get its warrant, as it were, from the totality of the empirical sciences. Even the mathematics that's embedded in that is ultimately grounded on empirical practice. And, you know, that's worked out, I think, in a very interesting and sophisticated way by Michael Resnick. I discuss his work in the book. But I don't want to be committed to something like that. And I don't want to be committed, on the other hand, to saying that there's a real a priori in mathematics, as many people want to believe. I want to maintain neutrality on those issues by saying just that, you know, we have some sort of constitutive element, and mathematics is a prime example of that. But what the ultimate status is doesn't matter in terms of it functioning as an a priori element.
Mm-hmm.
It could function as an a priori element, whether it's empirical or it's synthetic a priori. So I'm really just trying to neutralize possible trouble I could get into
right.
in philosophy of mathematics.
Right.
That chapter, trying to distance myself from the arguments. Now, in terms of the indispensability argument, I mean, a lot of people have criticized that in various ways, but the thing that is related to the whole project of the constitutive a priori is that part of the indispensability argument is this conformational holism. That is, that theories get theories that are embedded get their grounding or warrant from the periphery, from the totality of the theory. And that's what Quine thinks. And that's why his name is associated with the indispensability argument. But and that is a view that I do want to reject. That is, I don't think that's the right way of thinking about the epistemological warrant of things. I see them as hypothetical, but not as getting their grounding from their empirical use. So, you know, that's a way in which, and you can separate the just simply the indispensability argument in the sense that, well, you use these terms and you take them literally, and therefore mathematical entities must exist. There's a further claim about conformational holism that that some people making the indispensability argument make use of.
Right. Okay. So would it be, this is, we're running out of time, so just sort of a last quick question here on the book. So would it be correct to say that, from your perspective, that, you know, discussions of the a priori in science have been, you know, a little bit off course because of the focus on mathematics, and that, you know, really there are features of mathematics in particular that have been taken to be, you know, essential to or constitutive of the a priori. And those features are really just, you know, that's mathematics. And we happen to use those examples a lot. And they play a historically important role, but actually, you know, that was kind of a mistake. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the way I would put it is something like this. The focus has really been wrong in this discussion. Mm. Rather than focusing on a priori and what that means, and that's got a lot of intellectual baggage with it, I think we should focus on this role that the constitutive elements play in science. And, you know, many of those things are going to, some of the prime examples of that are going to be mathematics and the role it plays in science. But it's not the only example. There are these other presuppositions and even metaphysical kind of claims that are groundings for science. And if we focus on the practice of science and the role of the constitutive elements, I think we'll get a lot better analysis of what's going on in science than we will if we rehash debates about a priori knowledge or, you know, something like that.
Okay.
And that's the ultimate aim. I am a philosopher of science, and I see my project as part of at least not in a detailed single case kind of way, but in a broad sense, trying to set a framework for understanding science as a practice.
So we have time for just one brief question. What's next for you? I mean, are you going to continue along the same vein and maybe elaborate this constitutive element view, or are you working on something totally different? Or
what? Well, I think I have to do some more work to justify and explain the fallibilism and why how you can be non-relativist and also non-foundationalist at the same time. I've made that argument in the book, and I've made it before in a separate article, but I think a lot of people are still confused about that.
Mm-hmm.
How you can be a thoroughgoing fallibilist with no absolutes at all, and then yet say there's objective knowledge. So I think I have work to do in that field.
Okay.
Say I make a case, but it's a sketch rather than a really full-blown argument.
Right. Well, we are out of time. So I just want to thank you for a very enlightening discussion. It's been very, very interesting to know about, you know, how these different views relate to each other and then understand how your view kind of advances the conversation. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with David J. Stump. His new book, Conceptual Change and the Philosophy of Science, Alternative Interpretations of the A Priori, is just out from Routledge. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.